This week on Network Europe, the French are revolting again. This time it's about education rights and about rights of passage.
France, you know, students love to protest. You know, this is part of our culture.
A new poll in France says Belgium's Walloons are welcome to join them. We hear what the Belgians think of that. Can European foreign ministers rap? We let you decide. And also on the programme, Germany's shopkeepers go head-to-head with the church over Sunday trading. All of that and more on this week's Network Europe, coming to you from Hilversum in Holland with me, Richard Walker. The French have been practising a favourite national pastime this week. It may be cold, but it's strike season again in France. This time it was about pensions. But there's more. Public service employees and teachers say they're going on strike in the coming days over education reforms. And unsurprisingly, students are joining in with another strike of their own. RFI's Sarah Elsas has more.
For a couple of weeks now, students across France have been gearing up for a fight. Over the past week, they've shut down a dozen campuses and staged demonstrations against education reforms proposed by the government in August. Students are protesting the law, which they see as the first step towards privatizing university education.
They want to stop paying for universities, and they want the industry to pay for all the work there is to do.
Jessica Lebriquiere is studying English and Spanish at the Sorbonne. The law will make all state-run universities independent within 5 years, giving them the right to control their own budgets and tuition and accept private donations. One thing that worries students like Labriquière is that private companies can fund specific departments, which she says will put pressure on students to study what she calls profitable subjects.
We won't be free anymore to study what we want, like philosophy. They'll push us to study economy and all that. We won't be allowed to like study Russian or Portuguese because it's pointless for them.
Protesters are not just angry with the law, but with the general conditions of being a student in France. Annaigue Piedernière is studying history at Saint-Denis, north of Paris.
I cannot eat what I would like to eat every day. I would like to have enough books to study, but I cannot buy them.
On some level, protesting as a student is a kind of rite of passage in France. Jill Campagnola was a student here until last year. She's now getting a PhD in the United States and is researching student movements in France.
One of my questions I've been asking students here is this also part of an experience for you? And a lot of them have said yes. So it's not to diminish, you know, their claims, but I think France, you know, students love to protest. You know, this is part of our culture, so it's always... The thing about here is that we have a chance to go in the streets. We can say what we want. That's a great chance. And then the hard part is how to, you know, organize ourselves and really make claims that we'll change some things positively.
Only a handful of schools have joined the movement so far, though their numbers are growing. Campagnola sees these protests as the start of something bigger.
I think it's going to take off. If you look at 2006, there was this protest about the new labor law. It started like this.
Students were the main participants in protests the spring of 2006 against a law that would have made temporary work contracts for young people. It was scrapped following weeks of public pressure. This time around, students are hoping to do the same thing.
The movement is going bigger and bigger until the government answers to our questions and to our conditions of life.
The government has said it won't back down on reforming the universities, which was one of President Nicolas Sarkozy's main campaign pledges. For Network Europe, this is Sarah Elsis in Paris.
Now, despite being fond of blowing raspberries at authority, it seems the French are warm and welcoming when it comes to the francophone part of Belgium, or Wallonia. A new opinion poll in France says if Belgium was to split in half, Wallonia would be welcome to join it. Belgium's been in a government-free limbo for 5 months now. Long coalition talks are common enough after elections there, but the Belgian waffle is damaging the country. Politicians from rich Dutch-speaking Flanders in the north want more autonomy. In poorer Wallonia, though, they want to maintain the power of the Belgian state. The failure to form a government is strengthening the case of those who believe that the interests of Flemings and Walloons are now irreconcilable and that it's time for the two to say adieu. John Laurenson reports now for Network Europe from the Walloon city of Liège, from a bar.
A bar in all appearances like any other. A little worse than any other, in fact, a French cafe after a stylectomy. The lights too bright, the decors all over the place, old beer adverts, a bronze Buddha. But that's Jacques Brel on the radio and the Belgian tennis star Justine Henin on Eurosport. The regulars are eating cabbage stew with bowls of chips and the waiter hands me the beer menu. Now I know what the Buddha's doing here. This is Belgian Nirvana.
Belgian, it's like Saudi Arabia. We don't have to work. We have our beer, so we export our petroleum.
The filmmaker and provocateur Yann Boucquoi, whose book about Belgium, La Vie est Belge, came out earlier this year. He believes Belgium is a country blessed with big beers and small egos. Being Belgian, and therefore from a little country, is a lesson in humility. And being from small town Wallonia, even more so.
Wallonia doesn't exist. They have no culture. In Wallonia you have Mons. I don't think you never sold a book in Mons, you know. You have Charleroi, it's a kind of Bronx. Eh? La Louvière, where the surrealists were, you know, it's a bit more funny, but I think there's 30% of unemployment. They have a big heart. They are more Latin somewhere. They take their time. That's the country of Flanders, who don't take the time for nothing, who only thinking on work, have a big house and very clean. Huh? No sperma on the walls.
On a Friday night in the crisscross of narrow streets in the middle of Liège they call the Carré, there's more beer drunk per square metre than anywhere else in the entire world. Just outside the Carré, where people haven't yet got all slurry, I spend an hour stopping people in the street and asking them what it is to be Walloon. Those that don't think, who's this weirdo, and walk away really fast, all say the same thing.
On sait s'amuser à Liège. C'est rigoler.
We know how to have fun. We like to have a laugh. The heavy industry that once made the Walloons rich has shut and gone away, and now the Flemings want to leave them too. Some respond with bleak, realist art house movies that win the Palme d'Or at Cannes, but most just go out for a few beers. The right spirit, perhaps, but some way short of a national identity. Liège MP Didier Renders, head of the Reform Movement, the biggest political party in Wallonia today, opens a press conference on the latest talks on forming a government. He says governing Belgium is increasingly like governing two nations instead of one. But only the Flemings behave as if they've got a country of their own.
If you are looking to cycling in Flanders, you may see many flags from the Flanders region. If you are going to the south of the country, you may be see a lot of Belgian flags, some local flags, or the flags of the different teams, but not the regional one.
Le Chant de Wallon, adopted by the Parliament of Wallonia as their national anthem in 1998. Stirring stuff. Or it would be if anyone had heard of the Song of the Walloons. One anthem people in Liège do know is the Marseillaise. They sing the French national anthem every Bastille Day. The French national holiday, too, is a huge party in Liège, much more so than the Belgian one. And while we're at it, Francophone Belgians watch French TV, followed this summer's elections in France as keenly as their own, and supported France in the Rugby World Cup. Walloons now even have a small rattachiste movement that's trying to reunite French-speaking Belgium with France. Its leader is Paul-Henri Jandebien.
Les Wallons ne savent pas ce qu'ils sont.
The Walloons don't know who they are because they've forgotten they're a part of France. We need France's republican and relatively centralized political system. We need this great power's economic muscle to modernize our economy. Joining France would lift us out of the gloom and lack of self-confidence that characterizes the population today. Hello.
A group of students in Brussels trying to remember the Belgian national anthem. This country was created after the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo, just a short march from here. For Mr. Jean de Bien, the victor's decision to divide Wallonia from France was similar to the partition of Germany after World War II. But Germany reunited. Why shouldn't we? He asks. Charles de Gaulle once told the Walloons that France would welcome them with open arms should they vote for unification. I phoned the French Foreign Ministry to ask whether their offer's still good. No comment. But France's land borders contain a lot of territory that once did not belong to it. Indeed, France, this last 100 years, has expanded like a large man loosening his belt after dinner. Perhaps one day, French-speaking Belgians will be able to forget about learning the Belgian national anthem altogether. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Liège.
An uncertain future for Belgium, and so too for the musical careers of two of Europe's most senior politicians. Germany's Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier and his French counterpart Bernard Kouchner took some time out from the recent Franco-German summit to record a song about the plight of immigrants in Germany, with the professional help of rapper Muhabbet.
Das ist der Refrain.
Deutschland.
Perfekt.
Perfekt.
Ah.
Why, France, as it is, basket and nothing. And I'm sorry.
But let's nur bring...
Nur noch okay, den Kopf hören wir heute schwer. Das
singen wir.
Das
ja,
das und das. Hier ist noch ein Feminist in Schwarz. Alter.
Four time Deutschland, then Frankreich, then Deutschland.
That's Turkish-German rap artist Muhabbet featuring German and French foreign ministers Steinmeier and Kouchner, two of the highest profile politicians ever to appear on a rap record, I believe. Muhabbet, I should tell you, is quoted this week as saying he thinks the murdered Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh got off lightly. Mr. van Gogh was shot and stabbed to death on an Amsterdam street 3 years ago. The rapper says he'd like to have taken him to a cellar to torture him first. There's an interesting collaboration between mainstream politics and reactionary intolerance. But what were the official reasons for the two great men wanting to get down with the kids? Brussels correspondent for Radio Netherlands Worldwide, Vanessa Mock, told me a short while ago.
Well, on the face of it, what they say is they want to just show how keen they are to improve the integration of minorities in their respective countries. They say that they face a similar range of problems in terms of having the minorities really be part of society, etc. Of course, it's also a big showcase piece to try and prove just how close the two countries are. And last but not least, of course, the French Foreign Minister, Mr. Kouchner, is always up for any kind of media occasion that will allow him to flaunt himself before the cameras or the microphone.
Yeah, there's a long line of politicians who have failed to make an impact in the music world, and they should pay attention to that, I think. But anyway, moving on. We've had a couple of very interesting developments in the EU this week, Vanessa. For the 13th year in a row, European auditors have found that the EU squanders its revenue. Perhaps that's not going to surprise an awful lot of people, but it's still very embarrassing, isn't it?
Yeah, and it certainly will fuel criticism from Eurosceptic groups, especially in places like Great Britain. It is a cleaner bill of health than it has been in recent years, but still, a quite sizable 4 billion euros of EU budget is apparently mismanaged or wasted. Just to give you a bit of an idea, that's 4 billion out of a total budget of 107 billion, and apparently some of that money, which should be going to things like supporting agriculture or helping development in some of the EU's poorest regions, is instead ending up in golf clubs, horse riding clubs, railway companies, city councils, who apparently are skimming off millions. There are apparently no cases of major scams, but just a lot of mismanagement, and unfortunately it doesn't make very good headlines for the European Union.
I wonder how avoidable it is in such a large organisation like the European Union to avoid waste on some kind of scale. All large countries have waste in their budgets, don't they?
Exactly, exactly. And when you look at it as, you know, the percentage of the total figure, it's not that much. But still, there are now growing calls for the European Commission to pay a lot closer attention, especially to something called the structural funds, which is basically these funds that go to help generate the poorest corners of the European Union, which is apparently where the biggest amount of fraud and mismanagement and waste is really taking place.
Now, Romania is one of the poorest countries in the Union, isn't it? And this week it's been in something of a row with Italy. Can you give us the details?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a spectacular amount of mudslinging this week at the European Parliament, which is sitting in Strasbourg. This is all coming off the back of a lot of public anger triggered in Italy at a series of crimes blamed on poor Romanian immigrants, which has caused a lot of tension between the two countries. Now, this week, the granddaughter of the late Italian dictator Mussolini, Alessandra Mussolini, made a whole series of claims against Romanians. She said that Italy was being invaded by a band of criminals, that 70% of all foreign criminals sitting in Italian jails were Romanians, and that they were bringing violence and discrimination against women into their country, and basically they should be kicked out. Now, her remarks triggered actually the complete collapse of her party in the European Parliament, which is the only far-right party in the Parliament. It's called the Identity, Tradition and Sovereignty Group, because five Romanian MEPs decided to just walk out of the group.
And we have a clip of one of those MEPs explaining what he thinks of Mrs. Mussolini.
Madame Mussolini, pour moi, personnellement, c'est une poupée gonflable. J'étais d'une sex shop, je voulais être très clair.
Well, this one Romanian MEP saying, for me, Ms. Mussolini is an inflatable doll, and not just any inflatable doll, but the kind of doll that you find in a sex shop.
I'm not sure where else you'd get one, but
and that was something that he announced in the middle of the plenary meeting in Strasbourg. So you would have had several hundred MEPs listening to those comments, and then a whole series of verbal abuse ensued.
This did indeed lead to the collapse of the far-right grouping in the European Parliament, and we can hear that happening and the reaction to it from the other MEPs in Strasbourg.
I have today received letters from Mrs. Daniela Buruiana Aprodu and Mr. Christian Stanescu announcing their decision to leave the ITS group. I conclude that the number of members of the ITS group has now fallen below the minimum of 20 members required to form a political group. As a consequence, the group ceased to exist with effect from the moment of this announcement. Thank you, colleagues. Bon appétit.
Barely disguised pleasure at the collapse of the far-right group from the speaker there, and obviously from the floor as well.
Yeah, I think it was very much on the cards. There was a lot of condemnation at the forming of this group back in January when they finally got together after months and months of trying to bring these very disparate MEPs who all have their own agendas, their own national agendas, together to form a group. And they've been squabbling and infighting ever since they got together. They haven't really achieved much in terms of trying to block any reforms, etc., in the European Parliament. So I think there was a sort of collective sigh of relief, I think it's fair to say, on the whole, in Strasbourg this week.
It's been a year since Germans stopped worrying about nipping down to the shops and finding them closed. In most German states now, shops can open for business 24 hours a day and 6 days a week. The most progressive rules are in Berlin, where shops can open 10 Sundays a year. But don't forget, 6 days shalt thou labour and do all that thou hast to do, but the seventh is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. With that in mind, Catholic and Protestant churches say Sunday trading shouldn't be going on and that it violates the German constitution. This week, the churches brought their case against the state of Berlin before Germany's highest court. Thomas Marzel reports for Network Europe Now from the German capital.
Just a decade ago, shopping in Germany was a bear. Stores never seemed to be open, least of all when you got off work during the week, while on Saturdays it was a sweat-inducing race against the clock before the shutters came down around midday. Sunday shopping? Forget it. Federal laws no longer regulate shopping hours in Germany. In 2006, it became the state's responsibility. They immediately expanded opening hours. Berlin took it a step further. Whether it's a new wardrobe, a screwdriver, or just a loaf of bread, on 10 Sundays each year, you won't go, so to speak, hungry. Consumers breathed a sigh of relief, but not the churches.
We think 10 Sundays is too much. It's almost a breaking of the rule. It's no more just an exception.
Stefan Fauna is spokesman for the Berlin Catholic Archdiocese. He cites the German Constitution. It states, almost uniquely, that Sundays are a day of rest and recuperation. That's why Berlin's Catholic and Protestant churches have jointly filed a lawsuit at the German Constitutional Court against a Sunday shopping provision. They don't want shopping banned altogether on Sunday, but 10 times a year goes too far. Ulrich Seelemann is the head administrator for the Protestant Church of Berlin and Brandenburg.
Wir haben hier in unserer Kultur seit der Weimarer Reichsverfassung den Sonntagsschutz als einen wesentlichen Bestandteil.
Sundays have enjoyed a special protection in German culture and under the German constitution since the Weimar Republic. We don't want to lose that higher good just because one state passes a law. If German society as a whole deems it necessary to change the rules regarding Sunday, then it should overturn the relevant paragraph in the constitution. Don't just pass a state law.
Berlin's Minister for Consumer Affairs and Health, who regulates shop hours, was not available for comment. But a spokeswoman said the government was confident the court would find in Berlin's favor. Outside the Galerie Lafayette department store on the upmarket Friedrichstrasse, workers are putting up vast strands of Christmas lighting. Shoppers here support the longer opening hours and say they were mostly baffled over the lawsuit.
I don't like the rules on shop opening hours. It's important to be flexible today. The church may see things one way, but I see them differently. You have to be open-minded in our society, and one way is to throw out the rules on opening hours.
I like the stores to be open on Sunday and even close at like late at night. And it's a nice thing for, first, you can go shopping whenever you like. And the second thing is that, especially on Sundays, living in Germany is like being buried alive. And I think if the shops would be opened, it would be a little bit more lively.
What do you think of the rule that stores are allowed to be open for 10 Sundays a year?
Well, he should do as he pleases. If he finds customers, he can open at midnight. Why not? Mm-hmm. Whose business is that? I think the religion should keep very, very quiet and let people arrange things for themselves.
Not far from the Galerie Lafayette are the headquarters of the HDE, the German Retail Federation. Its managing director, Hubertus Pellinger, says he was surprised when Berlin passed the new shopping laws. The HDE had lobbied for only 4 shopping Sundays. Shopping on Sunday should be the exception, he says, rather than the rule.
We are very interested in the court case because then we'll hopefully get a clear answer on Sunday store hours. But there's also the economic issue. How many Sundays are viable so that shopping on Sunday remains something special? If Sunday becomes just another shopping day, then it isn't worth it because the labor costs are so much higher.
Besides, he says, he's yet to see a boost in sales figures, either in Berlin or nationwide. And as for the church, is it worried people could forsake the altar in favor of the shopping mall? The Catholic Church's Stefan Ferner says the lawsuit has nothing to do with self-interest.
And we don't do it for our lobby, for people, to make people go to the church. This is not our idea. We do it for the society, because we think it's important to have this culture of Sunday.
Ulrich Seelemann of the Protestant Church agrees. He says the goal isn't a return to what he calls the Middle Ages for consumers, but neither is he for all shopping all the time.
Es ist einfach wichtig, dass, glaube ich, die Menschen einen Tag brauchen, wo sie von ihrer Beschäftigung, von ihrem Lebensrhythmus her.
I think it's crucial that people have one day each week that's different from the others, when life's a bit slower and more reflective. A day when they discover they are far more than just an economic cog in the wheel of commerce.
The court decision is expected sometime next year. Meanwhile, Berlin's parliament has continued to widen shopping hours. Now bakeries, flower shops, and flea markets can open on the most important Christian holidays of the year, Christmas Day and Easter Sunday. Thomas Martzall, DW Radio, Berlin.
In the Netherlands, a decision on whether or not to renew the Dutch mission to Afghanistan is pending again. And although this is an important subject for the whole country every time it comes round, the issue has taken on new complexities this year. In the 6 years that Dutch troops have been in the country, casualties have been low, but the majority of military fatalities have been in the last 6 months. Recent fighting's been much more intense, and it means Dutch troops now have to face a higher risk of being killed. John Tyler from Radio Netherlands Worldwide joins me now. John, you've been examining the issue and you recently spoke with an army chaplain stationed in the Afghan province of Uruzgan, who here describes being with a colleague who's been killed by a landmine.
He was on a mission with his group, Air Mobile Brigade, special group of the General's Reserve, so-called, those who are asked to do special things in the area. He walked over a place where were hidden old material, old mines. So he stepped on one of them as fifth. And there are pressure plate systems, so the first, no effect, the second, no effect, the third, the fourth, and the fifth, it was sufficient use that it make contact, and then there was this explosion. So fast, he probably didn't hear the explosion.
John, I mean, it seems like a strange idea in a way to talk about how soldiers might deal with death. Some people might assume that by joining the army, you've already got a bit of a handle on your own mortality, because it's a pretty risky business, isn't it, joining the army? But how do Dutch soldiers, now that they're facing death on a regular basis in Afghanistan, how are they dealing with it?
You're very right. Death is the same for soldiers everywhere. And sometimes I think it can be quite banal for a soldier when they're facing death. We think of it as something very romantic and exciting, but it just happens from one moment to the next. But for the Dutch military, from a sensibility coming from the Anglo-Saxon world, you have to get your head around what motivates a Dutch soldier, because they're not out there dying for country and flag. The Dutch are not a very militaristic or nationalistic country. And when I was doing this report, I spoke to this chaplain who we heard in the report earlier, Chaplain van der Vring in the Dutch military, who said that Dutch soldiers don't really go out there to die for country and flag, that it's really quite different here.
For us, of course, the Dutch flag is very important, but the NATO flag as well. We are part of a community, we are part of the Allied forces, and we feel like that, doing with each other, we work together. So it is more in this being connected with each other that we find this, being prepared to give our lives than just for the Netherlands or just for the American, for the United States or just for good old England or just for... No, we are members of a world community.
I mean, I don't mean to cast any doubt on what the chaplain was saying just then, but that does sound quite extraordinary to my ear, to fighting for a world community and the NATO flag. I mean, he alluded to camaraderie. I could understand that up to a point.
Well, one does have to dig a little bit further, because it does indeed seem rather vague. But he wasn't the only person that said to me that this idea of fighting for a greater ideal is strong in the Dutch military. Now, he was one of the people who said, yes, the company, the platoon, your fellow soldiers are a very strong motivation. But he also did refer right back to World War II, which is the last time the Dutch soldiers engaged in such heavy fighting, as a motivational force for Dutch people going out to far-reaching places in the world to fight. He said, well, in the Second World War, Canadians and Americans came over here. They had nothing to do with Europe, and they fought for us, and we live in a free society now, thanks to them. Now it's our turn.
So the suggestion then is that Dutch soldiers really do recognize a higher ideal, that they're fighting for a global peace, the war on terror, what our politicians tell us we are in Afghanistan and Iraq for. This is what motivates Dutch soldiers.
That's true, but just like everyone else, it's good if you can personalize that. And I think Dutch soldiers do personalize these kind of ideals in the form, a lot of times, of children and of young people. And of when a Dutch soldier is walking around the streets of Tarnkout, which is the capital of Uruzgan, has gone where they're now serving. And they say they see the people, they look them in the eye, they see the children playing on the street, and they feel like they're doing something for these particular people. Now, there's another reference point here that's very important for Netherlands, and that's Srebrenica, which was the enclave in the former Yugoslavia where Dutch soldiers were stationed as part of the NATO mission there. That's quite traumatic for both the Dutch military and Dutch society. And it's another place where a conflict has been quite personalized in the form of the people who were killed there. I talked to a sociologist here in the Netherlands, Dick Pels, and he told me a little bit about this trauma from Srebrenica.
We stood against the Serbs of Mladic in the town of Srebrenica and were not able to protect the Muslim population, and afterwards 7,000 Muslim men were killed by the Serbs, and we didn't see it coming. So this is the middle 90s. There's been a trauma for more than 10 to 15 years in the Netherlands. And I think the Dutch military wants to make good on this. It's a kind of atonement.
Okay, so making up for mistakes in the past there, that may ring true for the Dutch military, but there is also a lot of support for the Dutch military in Afghanistan from the Dutch public. Do you think they feel the same need for atonement, or do you think there's more of a sense of a European identity?
I think there's both. There's very definitely the sense among Dutch people of atoning for Srebrenica. It's not just the military. But the section of the population that supports the mission in Uruzgan, they're almost going over into a kind of a nationalistic fervor that's quite unusual here, and people are surprised about it. So as much as people say they're fighting for the NATO flag or grander ideals, there is this almost Americanized support our troops movement. There's even these bumper stickers here, like they have all over the United States. They are getting to be popular, with a ribbon on them that says support our troops, talking about Afghanistan. We even had a soldier who said a couple of weeks ago, "I'm prepared to die for my country."
The Swedish Security Service, or SAPO, has always been tight-lipped when it comes to discussing its work, and especially when it comes to international terrorism. But with a new director general at the helm, the door to the media's been wedged open a little. SAPO says some young radical Swedish Muslims pose a real security threat. SAPO's chief security analyst, Malena Remba, spoke to Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiros about Swedish national security and homegrown radicals.
We had a case a couple of years ago where two young individuals planned an attack on an Iraqi polling station just outside of Stockholm.
During the first Iraqi election?
Yes. And they radicalized over the internet. They perhaps didn't come from very traditional Islamist upbringing, but they chose a simplified version of radical Islam and justify their actions through this interpretation.
How serious a threat is this to national security?
Most of these do not have serious training in arms or from terrorist training camps. Even so, with the attack I just outlined, you can see that they can cause damage even with their limited knowledge. If they also go abroad for example, jihad training or jihad participation in local conflicts elsewhere in Iraq or Somalia, then they gain practical experience that can be used and, of course, multiply their abilities. They also gain experience in terms of credibility among their friends, so they can become a magnet for radicalization upon their return if they survive their experiences elsewhere.
Do we know if they've undergone such trainings?
There have been young men traveling abroad in the last year. They have traveled to areas where there is conflict going on. And without going into details of what actually happened or why they went, those are examples. We do know that both of Swedish nationality and of other nationality have travelled from Sweden to local conflict areas.
You've also indicated that these individuals pose a threat to national security, which in a way could be considered to be worse than Al-Qaeda. What did you exactly mean by that?
To our knowledge today, we don't have Al-Qaeda members in Sweden. However, Al-Qaeda is a very strong center of radical Islamist messages. And when these young radicals in Sweden pick up these messages, they might become activated or feel justified in their actions. And if there's a message being sent out that it's a duty to act against certain activities in Sweden, for example, then these young radicals might be the ones who respond to this message, rather than Al-Qaeda sending an agent into Sweden.
Azaria Kira speaking to SAPO's chief security analyst Malena Remba there. That's all we've got time for in this week's edition of Network Europe. Please do visit our website at www.networkeurope.org. That's where you'll find this week's quiz question, which is a musical medley where you have to identify each of the three songs you'll hear. But for now, from me, Richard Walker, and all of my Network Europe colleagues around the continent, thank you very much for listening.
Four times Deutschland, then Frankreich, then Deutschland. Three times.
Was geht in dir vor, was macht dich so zornig? Schei mich nicht an, bleib doch vernünftig. Ich versteh dich auch so klar und deutlich. Es reicht, wenn du mit mir Deutsch sprichst. Komm, Dienstag, komm, wenn ich kann. Versteh mich und nimm mich wahr. Dein Urteil ist nicht wahr. Vergiss doch mal das schwarze Haar. Deutschland, warum verschließt du dich? Deutschland, leg deine Karten auf den Tisch. Deutschland, warum verschließt du dich? Deutschland, leg deine Karten auf den Tisch. Denkst du, ich werd mich ergeben? Denkst du, ich halt nicht dagegen? Denkst du, dass ich still und schweigend mich hier einfach auf deinen Boden leg? Komm runter, komm endlich klar. Versteh mich und nimm mich wahr. Dein Urteil ist nicht wahr. Vergiss doch mal das schwarze Haar. Deutschland, warum verschließt du dich? Deutschland, leg deine Karten auf den Tisch. Deutschland, warum verschließt du dich? Deutschland, leg deine Karten auf den Tisch. Deutschland, warum verschließt du dich? Deutschland, leg deine Karten auf den Tisch. Deutschland, warum verschließt du dich? Deutschland, leg deine Karten auf den Tisch. Deutschland, warum verschließt du dich? Deutschland, leg deine Karten auf den Tisch. Deutschland, warum verschließt du dich? Deutschland, leg deine Karten auf den Tisch.